Welcome to On the Brink Radio number 318. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson sitting here on the bank of the river, really near the platypus nest. Once again, it's the beginning of dusk, and it's a bit chilly and windy, and there's the incessant traffic going past here that really has never slowed down, even during the depth of the, as worse as the lockdown thing ever got here. There's always a massive amount of trucks going right through this town, and it's almost impossible to sit here by the river and just hear nothing but the sound of the birds and the wind and the willows and the leaves and stuff like that. But anyway, I won't record this whole show here. This show is about the sacredness of friendship, which is something that I always honor and always try to do everything I can for. Friendship to me is the highest form of relationship between people and other life forms too, and it includes love. Like, if you, friends are people that you love and who love you. So, and this has come really into very clear focus for me during this whole episode of the past few weeks, and I want to talk about that and honor not only my friends but the whole relationship known as friendship and how important that is. And also, the other part of the show is, it's kind of tentatively called Meanwhile Back at the Ranch. And I don't know where that comes from, some old TV show or something like that, but it comes into my mind to have to do with a scenario where you find that you've been out in la-la land, you've been out on a limb, you've been pursuing a story or something that sort of took you off what you were doing. You were distracted. Then all of a sudden, meanwhile back at the ranch, it means like, well, look, while you've been off paying attention to all these side shows, this is what's been going on that you haven't been paying attention to, but yet it's just proceeded along in its normal course. And so I want to talk about that in terms of the cosmic processes that have proceeded, that precede us and that have proceeded along all during our distraction, while the pirates have tried to snag the steering wheel from us while we are asleep. But also other things at the human level that have proceeded while we were looking over at all the coronavirus stuff, all the things that have proceeded at the next level, at bureaucratically, militarily, ecologically, environmentally, economically, subversively, psychologically, all the stuff. We won't pay too much attention to that. But also, and then look at cyclical forces and also other influences that might be periodic, they might be random, whatever sort of periodicity or aperiodicity we can assign to it, different sort of cosmic level influences that might be the drivers of these large scale changes, not specifically physically, like in climate or in, as we move through the arms of the galaxy, the solar system, and encounter different sort of clouds of comets and stuff like that, but more energetically and spiritually or consciousness wise. Fields of energy that might influence life on Earth and our consciousness that might help to explain the cyclical variation that the Hindus call the yugas, and that seems to be borne out in the cycles of other, you know, it's like other cultures have noted and remarked on and recorded and encoded into their stories and mythology these long-term sort of cycles of history or prehistory or being. So anyway, this is what I'd like to explore on the show. I just wanted to record a little bit here out in nature in honor of it being the day after the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. And I'm sitting here by the river. My feet can almost stick in the water where the platypus nest is not too far away. And I'm several varieties of water birds, ducks and geese and maybe some swans and some herons are always here. And it's very beautiful to be here in Tasmania. but I'll record the rest of the show back in the quiet and warmth of my little command and control module. I'm back in my command and control unit now, out of the wind, a bit of warmth. When I think of friendship, I think of two different people that I've interviewed for my show and talking about either beings from the ocean or life in the ocean in general. One of them is Gabby Duncan, the Gomeroi Darkenjung whale dreaming elder who I interviewed, I guess it was back in 2014, 2015, up in the Central Coast. He shared with me a lot of ancient whale dreaming stories and sort of confirmed some of the things that I had already come to intuitively believe, that the whales and dolphins had actually truly been people. Not human beings, but people, in the sense of the essential criteria defining what a person is. It implies a sense of individuality, self-awareness. But not only that they were people long before humans, but that they actually taught us or showed us the way, helped us to become people way back in the day in terms of our evolution. But they've been here so much longer. 30 million years is the commonly given figure, as opposed to Homo sapiens. I mean, we've probably been biologically quite similar to how we are now for at least a few hundred thousand years, if not a million. But I mean, all these numbers don't really mean anything, but it's the cultural and the software evolution that really is what's changed in us. Anyway, Gabby Duncan was talking about one of the central qualities of the cetaceans, the whales and dolphins, was the importance that they put on kinship, their relationship with their families and their extended community and their tribe, or whatever you want to call it, but their sense of kinship. And to me, that's intimately related, if not practically synonymous with friendship. I mean, kinship kind of implies that you're related genetically, but that's just sort of a connotation in modern day English. Kin, like your kin, is the people that are your biological family. But kinship could be like if you feel a kinship with the animal kingdom, or a kinship with the plant kingdom, kinship with rocks. It means you feel a connection. So friendship is definitely a form of kinship. And also, my friend Terry Lilly, the underwater photographer, I call him Mr. Limpet because he would probably spend all his time underwater if he could get away with it, but he tries to go scuba diving for a few hours every day, to the point that I think when I meet him in person, I'm going to make him show me his neck so I can see where the gill slits are. Anyway, he said in one of our earlier interviews that he felt that when you're down under the water with all the life forms, that he goes in the same areas, and so there may be beings there that actually recognize him because they see him repeatedly, like fish, turtles, eels, things that can't move like corals and seaweeds and who knows, all different kind of octopus, anybody that can be down there. But he said that they all exhibit kind of a sense of harmonious relationship with each other. And I don't know if he used the word kinship, but that's kind of what it's expressing. And so it could be, I mean, this is pretty big, but it could be that when you live in the ocean, you're more, every individual organism is more intimately connected by being in water, and especially ocean water, which is quite similar to human blood in many ways. Every being in the ocean is connected by water and what that means, rather than being connected or separated by a volume of gas, which we call air, a much less dense medium that's got totally different conductive properties and insulating properties. And water is, air has some water in it, but not all that much. So it could be that being in water, which is probably where all life we know came from, all life probably used to, all of life was probably in the ocean for a long time. So that spirit of aqueous kinship really defines the true nature of being here now as fellow passengers, crew of Mother Earth. And so I would say that what we call friendship is actually just sort of, if not synonymous with, it's a large subset of the kinship that all water-based life feels with itself, because we're all made of water and we're all connected on the molecular wavelengths of water. Which, now this is very interesting, because they talk about how water has very interesting properties unlike any other substance. It's got a unique bonding angle. It's got hydrogen bonds that allow each atom of water to sort of flow and tumble, that gives it its liquid capability. And also, because of the way the hydrogen bonds work, that any contiguous body of water functions chemically and electromagnetically as if it were one molecule, regardless of how big this body of water might be. So if you extend that principle to include not only the world's ocean as one giant macromolecule of water, you'd also have every life form that's got probably the biggest constituent component of life, of any life form, is water. So we're water's way of like walking around on the land. But we all exhibit the kinship resonance capabilities of water relating with itself. So we're really an expression of the water, which is the life of Mother Earth. And so this may be why friendship to me has always seemed like the normal way of relating. Like, I've always felt, I've never been afraid or paranoid of people I don't know. It's like the opposite. I just sort of came to feel that everyone that you've never met, which is most people, but that they're actually potentially your friend, you just haven't got to meet them yet. Usually a friend implies somebody that's aware of your existence, but you could sort of have anonymous friends that would be your friend if you ever met or ever connected. But, and so this was really sort of amplified and backed up and reaffirmed, and I don't know if I ever actually formulated it as a thought, but after all the hitchhiking I've done for close to 40 years, not so much in the past 5 years, but all ever since about 1983, when I really started, hitchhiked about 150,000 miles in 47 states in Canada, and then in the year 2000 came down under and started doing the same thing down in Australia and New Zealand. So now I'm well over 400,000 kilometers of hitchhiking, probably with well over 10,000 individual rides of people with just a very, 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 very minuscule number of rides where two or three times I got picked up by the same person twice. Barring that, that's many, many thousands of people who I'd never met before, never knew existed, who then became a friend, at least during the time we were riding. And there's only a few exceptions to that. So, in other words, this is what really... I used to worry back in the early years about, you know, is the bad thing going to happen? Blah, blah, blah. And so finally my mind gave up on running those tape loops, because it just never happened. In fact, it was so much the opposite that I came to just trust. I mean, you've still got to have your alert on and be on your toes, ready for the unexpected. But I really feel like the whole world, and not just of people, but the whole world of life, is really a world of friendship and kinship. And sure, if you watch all the BBC nature documentaries, they show all the predatory behavior and the weird, violent destructiveness, and they're trying to point that out. They go, oh, people like glorify how beautiful and peaceful dolphins are, and people go like, oh, but don't they rape each other? And don't they sometimes kill each other? And I go, but they're people too. They've got their own quirks and frailties and imperfections, but I definitely do not think anything like that is the norm with them far less than it is with us. I mean, we would be by far the most violent of species because, as far as I know, no other species of life engages in violence or destructiveness just out of a gratuitous sense of enjoyment or boredom or malice. I think it's all, sure, cats might play with something before they eat it, you know, but in general, animals hunt something for food, and that's it. But look at what humans do. But that's not what this show is about. This show is about the sacredness of friendship, and I think that this whole episode the past few weeks is really showing us how sacred friendship really is, and how much we really do need and depend on each other, and how much we really need to exhibit the highest level of coherence in our sharing and sense of community, and our attenuating the inherent selfishness that accompanies a fully blown capitalistic society. I think that's part of one of the lessons with all this, is a lot of societies kind of getting shaken down to the bare essentials. And you know, it's very, very, very complex. But we're all friends. We're all the passengers crew of Mother Earth. And to do what Carl Sagan, the astronomer, recommended when he was talking about the dangers of nuclear war, he said if we expand our horizons of identity so that we... He was only talking within the human kingdom, but if we expand... Normally, our identity is like your, if you think of what your identity is, it's you as a single person. But you could, I think indigenous peoples, their identity was more like their family or their local tribe or clan, their community. So if you could expand your horizon of identity to include all people, Sagan reckoned that would attenuate our intertribal conflicts and aggressive behavior that would leads to what we call war in the traditional geopolitical sense. So if we expand our horizon identity beyond even our own species to include Mitukaye Oyasan, all our relations, every member of every species of life, and that's a huge amount of beings. But that's the reality. This is the true reality of being on Mother Earth right now, is that there's, for every species of life we know about, plant, animal, fungi, all the different kingdoms of life, and even I include rocks as life forms, for all the different millions of kinds that we know of species, think of how many individuals there are of each of those, how many individual Paramecians there are, how many individual euglenas there are, how many individual butterflies of each species, how many individual blades of grass, how many individual turtles or crocodiles or hummingbirds or glossy black cockatoos or koalas or thylacines or bottlenose dolphins or humpback whales or leeches or eels or crocodiles. Oh my! Yet, this is the reality of who our passengers crew of Mother Earth are. The sum total of every member of every species of life. And so, this is Mitukaye Oyasan, and this is our family. And they're all there. They've all been there this whole time while we've been distracted by this big... a spectacle of distraction that has got us all by the balls over the past few weeks. Everything else, the whole universe has proceeded along in its normal course, pretty much oblivious to all the stuff that we've become obsessed with in our mental frame of reference. This predominantly psychological warfare operation called the coronavirus pandemic has really seized the day of the public mindshare and created almost a total eclipse of the totality of our spectrum of awareness. But I think one of the biggest things that it showed us is exactly how asleep at the wheel we've become, and we were drifting off course. probably ever since the dawn of civilization. And now that the pirates tried to grab the wheel, we realized that we didn't really have it in control. We didn't realize what course we were on. We were just sort of meandering until now the pirates have grabbed the wheel and put it on a certain course towards oblivion that we really don't like. So now we realize that we can no longer continue to escape from freedom, in the words of my favorite psychologist of the 20th century, Eric Fromm, the title of one of his very most influential books, Escape from Freedom. He talks about how the reason that whole societies would fall prey to fascist regimes like the Third Reich and Nazi Germany was because, as a whole, the people didn't want the responsibility of making their own decisions for what they were going to do and how they were going to live day to day. They would prefer to be told what to do, even if it was quite bizarre or destructive or even not in their own self-interest. So I think that we've just had a slap in the face telling us that that mentality is very much alive and well, and this, it's just had a go at our jugular vein, and it's not going to work. But we got to learn from this lesson. We've got to seize the helm. And so, meanwhile, back at the ranch, meaning all the things that have been continuing to go along in their normal way, while we weren't watching, while we've watched the chick in the bikini, while the magician reaches in and pulls something out of his pocket and pretends like it came out of the hat, our attention has been distracted by the Trumpisms of the world, and all the disasters and all the media hype and all the exaggerated, the fear porn, all the stuff. It's all designed to press certain buttons in you to capture your attention. That's what it's all about, to focus your attention and to keep getting it day after day. That's why all these headlines, like the really bizarre stuff by Mike Adams, the health ranger, I just really, that dude disgusts me now, because I feel it. I feel it in my solar plexus when I see some of these headlines. It's like they're broadcasting the worst possible case scenario ideas about, oh, it's never going to return to normal, or, you know, like, oh, there's bodies piling up, or there's like, you know, this country's got like a million more deaths than we ever thought possible, because it's all the Chinese propaganda, you know, that's making it seem like it's not that bad. And it's just a morass of complete insane bullshit. So while we've been all focusing on this, sure, it's having effects on a lot of people. It's affecting pretty much the majority of people to a degree. I mean, I know in terms of, at least I'm one of the luckiest people in that so far I haven't really had to do anything different from my normal life except spend a lot of time talking about this and sort of trying to figure out what it is that's going on. It's like a battle of realities. It's a cognitive titanomachy. But the point of this part of the show is to look at, once we get back to the ranch of Mother Earth and the heliocosm, and to look at what's been going on, like for the past few weeks, Australia has still been reeling, especially Victoria, New South Wales. They weren't never recovered from the bushfires. That was just not that long ago. I mean, that just ended in January. Just literally, that had just ended when all this stuff hit the fan. And it's like all the life forms that have been displaced and have no homes and now don't have a place to live and they don't have anything to eat. And like the koalas and the glossy black cockatoos and the lyrebirds and the forest owls and the anticlinus and all the petty melons and potoroos and all these beautiful beings, the goannas and the frill-neck lizards, and the list goes on and on and on. And all this horrific healing and recovery is just really beginning. But you've got stuff that's been secretly rolled out during this time, like the Australian government making all these shady logging deals to go into some of the forest areas that, not only ones that were burned, but ones that weren't burned, in areas that have never before been logged. Mining deals going ahead. the whole thing of the Chinese vulturism swooping down and buying up. I mean, it's really hard to have much of a perspective because this was already a huge, huge, huge issue in Australia in particular. The influence of China, how many people from China are in Australia, and how much money of Australia comes from China in terms of business and trade and tourism and university students and all this stuff. And so it seems like now, I mean, we're continuing to hear about Chinese business interests taking over this and that dairy or mining industry or buying islands in the Great Barrier Reef and just all the stuff. And so who really knows what kind of transformations are taking place behind closed doors? We've got the even though with all the people not able to drive and the drop in oil prices and the reduced oil consumption and consequent improvements in air quality in places, anything that's military, nothing military has slowed down at all. In fact, it's all hyped up, and who knows where all they're deploying NATO and American stuff now. Venezuela, Iran, Syria, it could be anywhere. I mean, and this is just what we're somehow able to know about. It's like, you know, I think pretty much in the world of today, anything like that we know about, it's only because they want us to know. It's not likely that there's enough independent news. Well, I don't know. It's very complex. I can't say that. I think that there are eyes and ears that aren't owned by the intelligence octopus that do allow us to know a lot of stuff. But it's like with all the top secret classified military projects that the Pentagon and DARPA and the Jason Group and all this stuff. I mean, we were able to find out about a lot of this really top secret classified stuff. For example, Dr. Nick Begich and his work exposing and sharing with us what HAARP was before it was even built. As that was equivalent to somebody getting in there and understanding and figuring out what the Manhattan Project was up to and telling us about that before they detonated the atomic bomb. That was at that level. But that's, when you think of, that's one thing that was huge that we did find out about, but how many more sort of technological juggernaut endeavors like that could be underway that we just have no idea about? But it's probably because so much of the research is done, even though it might be highly compartmentalized, it's still done by universities and think tanks and people. So a lot of it does get out kind of like through the grapevine. But I'm still guessing that there's a lot of stuff, very insidious stuff, that we don't know about. Then, so you've got the constant military rollout stuff that hasn't let up at all. You've got the... For a while, I thought that the governor of Hawaii was going to postpone the RIMPAC, Rim of the Pacific Naval War Games, the largest war game operation on the planet that happens every 2 years in Hawaii. That's really a form of waging war on the marine environment, actually everything on the land, too. The last I heard, they were going to postpone it, but now I think it's going on. It's still going ahead, but they're just asking the people to not come ashore. So... Anyway, that's all. Nothing military has slowed down. And we've got the continuous rollout of the, people call it 5G, which is probably not really the right thing to call it, but it's a new level of technology with all these hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of satellites being put up by Elon Musk and Rocket Lab and other companies that supposedly has to do with not providing internet service, but with creating what Alana Freeland calls a space fence. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So these few things I've named are just a few of the processes that Homo sapiens is inflicting on itself right now and on the earth. The Homo sapien macrovirus doing what it does best: attack, kill, and destroy. So this is all, none of this has changed because of the coronavirus. Now, in the solar system, we've got the planets going around the sun. We've got the seasons. We've got day and night. None of this has changed at all. I think we're at a sunspot minimum now. There has been a pretty good amount of earthquake activity in the past couple of weeks. There's been some very interesting comets coming through. Comet Atlas came, got really bright and then disappeared, and then Comet Swan came and replaced it. And then now there's an object called, I think it's called Borus something or other because of the guy who discovered it. It's the first interstellar comet, and the second object discovered passing through the solar system that's believed to not have originated in the solar system, or it's not it's not orbiting the sun. It's just sort of passing through. So this is very interesting, and it's very reminiscent of the work of Victor Klug and Bill Napier, the legendary comet astronomers that I was just getting into close touch with right when all this stuff hit the fan back in March. So I'd really like to pick back up on communicating with these guys. So we've got all the processes going on in the heliocosm, the Earth's magnetic fields, the magnetosphere. Apparently, there was a big dip in the Earth's magnetic field a couple of days ago. And I remember on that day, I felt a very weird feeling in my solar plexus that morning, kind of a sense of disturbance that I'd felt before, but I hadn't felt it in a really, really, really long time. And so then when I read about the solar flare, the geomagnetic storm, it made me realize that could be what I was feeling. There's been very little, I don't know if it's accurate for me to say that there haven't been very many whale and dolphin strandings in the past few months. I haven't heard about very many. So I don't know if this is an artifact of the reporting, or especially in the past few weeks, an artifact of there not being very many people out on the beaches and places where you'd see whales that had stranded. So we might be missing. But it seems like even before the coronavirus thing, in the preceding months there have been very, very, very few, which led me to wonder exactly what was going on. And now I'd like to just talk a little bit about cyclical variations that are talked about in various cultures. Kind of like we're talking about very long periods of time, on the even longer than the epochs of different climatological periods that, well, you know, like for, well, I think the best way to describe it is to call them seasons of a larger kind of a galactic year. And it may relate there, I mean, there's all kind of cycles. You've got like cycles of the sun, the sunspot cycle, the Milankovitch cycles. You've got the precession of the equinoxes and all different kinds of stuff like that. And Victor Klug and Bill Napier talk about periodic cometary waves that result from, and I don't know if this is periodic or it might happen every so often, but I don't know if there's a regularity to it. As the Earth passes through the plane of the galaxy, we encounter regions of higher densities of debris and material that form comets and stuff that can impact and turn into meteoric dust in the Earth's atmosphere and stuff like that. But I'm looking more at, like, not so much physical, mechanical, gravitational effects from motion and orbits and stuff, but more kind of like energetic variations, as if the solar system or the Earth was moving through regions with different energetic properties. And I don't know if you want to call it clouds of dust or fields of plasma or areas with where the ether, the legendary interstellar substance that was originally believed to be necessary, and then all of a sudden it couldn't possibly exist, and then now some people are going, well, maybe there is an ether, but I mean, you know, it doesn't really matter. But if we are experiencing variations in sort of large-scale cosmic energetic influences, understanding that may lead to our understanding of the whole cyclical nature of what the Hopi Indians call Koyaanisqatsi, what the Hindus call the Yugas, Y-U-G-A-S. And they talk about the yugas as if they're kind of analogical to these seasons of the year. You've got the golden age, or the Sat Yuga, Sat meaning truth. It's the longest one. It's the age of everything's really fine and dandy, and people are the true spiritual beings that we really are. We're all walking on the true path to the Great Spirit. We're all equally passengers coo of Mother Earth. We're all examples of the beauty and power of nature and living on the true path to the Great Spirit. This is the longest one. Then it kind of goes into an age of, some people compare it to metals. You've got gold, bronze, silver, and iron. So you'd go from the gold down to the silver, and then down to the bronze, where your energies are progressively dropping in frequency, and you're becoming more and more materialistic and more and more identified with the physical world and lower frequency vibrations and lower consciousness and more base drives and desires and fundamental motivations of behavior and degradation of relationships. And finally, in the Kali Yuga, named after Kali, K-A-L-I, the Hindu goddess of death and destruction, the shortest but the darkest age, during which we're humanity as a whole. Now, there's always going to be some people that are able to maintain the true path, but as a whole, humanity's completely lost touch with their true spiritual nature. It's an age of machines and warfare, external technology, greed, violence, killing. And so I'm not really all that clear about how long the Kali Yuga is supposed to last for, because supposedly it's the shortest, but they never give any sort of years. It's kind of like in the Bible. It's like the days of creation. It could be octaves of vibration for all we know. It could be units of musical time. The part that interests me the most is the transition between the ages, and especially because apparently, according to the ancient mythology, the Kali Yuga ends and it returns to the next golden age at a higher turn of the spiral. So trying to compare all this stuff with what we see happening in the world now, what we believe has been happening for the past few thousand years since the dawn of what we call civilization and the beginning of Kuyanaskatsi, the Hopi prophecy makes a lot of sense to me. But I think the golden age is an age in which people didn't have what we call civilization. It was people living indigenously with very minimal materialistic aspects, but living in true emphasis of kinship and friendship and relationship with each other and with all the species of life and with Mother Earth and with nature, all connected as if we were living underwater. And so how far into the Kali Yuga we are remains to be seen, because you think of like, well, are things actually getting better or are they getting worse? So I would say it's really hard, because I feel like with my own life, things keep getting better. My creativity, my levels of awareness, the synchronistic beauty and power that characterizes my life and travels and everything. But I see humanity's relationship with Mother Earth and with each other deteriorating, especially in terms of our relationship with non-human life. And then now we've got this whole global pandemic thing, which is, it's really nothing new. It's just the biggest example of stuff that they've been doing for a long time. It's factions of humanity waging war on larger factions of humanity, like an autoimmune disorder. So all this is just, you know, we have no way of really knowing if there is a Kali Yuga effect that affects non-human life. like if the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees, if they go through a dark age of materialism. I sort of don't think so. I think that humans are the only ones that are subject to all this, but that would mean, practically by definition, if it only affected humans, it would mean that it's purely a psychic thing that affects us in our mind and brain. It would be a psychic field, a cyclical variation in our psyche. Wow, this is very interesting to think about, because if you think of, like, well, all the trees and the whales and dolphins and the birds and the bees and stuff, they're fine, except for, you know, there might be areas of times of climatic variation, or there might be when an asteroid or a comet hits and they have a few hundred or thousand years of darkness and they have to struggle through these mass extinction events. But in terms of the cyclical variations that I'm talking about, be interesting to know what the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita has to say about that. And maybe the whales and dolphins can shed some light on that themselves on my behalf. But my intuition is that they are not affected. It's something that only affects humans because of a genetic aberration in our central nervous system, because of engineering by the Anunnaki, because of cognitional software virus that's crept into us from mushroom spores that came from the outer arm of the Andromeda galaxy. Who knows? All I know is that we're all still here now. We're all alive. This didn't kill us, so therefore, as long as it doesn't make us really, really, really sick, which is what Bill Gates and the WHO are hoping for, if we can avoid that, then it's just going to end up making us stronger. It'll make us harder to hurt next time, and maybe even strong enough to fend off there even being a next time for this thing. Maybe we can be inspired to seize the helm and navigate our own lives individually and collectively onto paths of the true path of the Great Spirit, and honor the sacredness of friendship and the power of kinship and our kinship with Mitikaya Yasin and Mother Earth, and to be more of the crew of Mother Earth and not just passengers, not just wasted protoplasm and excess baggage, but warriors and artists and creators and intelligent designers and navigators of the beauty and power, honoring all the beautiful gifts of creativity that we've been given, and to give thanks that oxygen, gravity, and sunlight are still free and in great abundance. We have very much to be thankful for. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson signing off for On the Brink Radio. Y'all come back now here. Thank you.
Thank you.